Groner.
Good morning.
Ready to proceed?
Good morning, Richard Groner for Mr. Vaughn. And morning, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to present this argument on behalf of Mr. Vaughn. What I would like to do, I've been thinking about how do I first approach this before you, and I think that the crux of the problem here is in the jury selection. And when you're in the process of dealing with a case, any case, especially in a case like this where it is so emotionally charged, you're dealing with an individual who is charged with multiple counts of sex assault. Carries with it, as you know, he was convicted and sentenced to 60 years. It could have been far more than that had the court moved to a consecutive sentence on the Class A felony convictions. In the process of making a jury selection, as you know, there is a large veneer that is called of a lot of people that come before that can be selected. And certainly in a case like this, where you're asking questions about the background and making sure and doing the best that you can to make sure that the 12 people that sit on that, sit in that box to weigh the evidence and be the judges of the facts are as unbiased and as unprejudicial as they can be. What happened in this particular case in review of the records is looking at the three individuals that were brought to bear and the actual one of the jurors that was in the box in the course of the presentation of the evidence. It seems to be clear that at least one, Ms. Switzer, who was a probation officer and had a personal affiliation with the prosecutors and, you know, had social interaction with the prosecutor's office and the prosecutor, his wife, or her, the spouse had social engagements with the prosecutor's office. I think that in and of itself should have been sufficient for a judge to say, you know, there's too close of an affiliation with this particular potential juror and the prosecuting attorney's office, one of the parties to this case, so that by excusing that potential juror and then going back into the panel certainly would not have been, I don't believe, too big of a problem. That didn't happen. That juror was challenged for cause. Then we go to Ms. Honda, which I think Mr. Shigetomi prepared this appeal. The first individual that he pointed out was Ms. Honda, who essentially came out of the box and said, I have a strong disfavor that any, I'm angered, and I'll quote out of the opening brief, I'm angered to know that any adult would take advantage of their position and hurt a child. Well, yes. And to say that I'm going to be unbiased and I'm not going to let any of my personal feeling play into my decision, I don't know if I can say that totally truthfully. I think I've formed some opinions already. My personal biases, I do have some biases. And when she was even told more about what the facts of the case was going to be, she essentially said that it makes her reaction even worse. Certainly.
But didn't she, at the end of the exchange between herself and the judge, basically say, I think I can be fair and impartial, but I can't tell you 100% sure?
That's right. And, you know, I understand the role of the court to want to make sure that the people that are on the bench, you know, can be fair and impartial, but it gets to a point of, are we rehabilitating this potential juror to make them, you know, nobody wants to feel that they are unfair and biased, but at the same time, when you're dealing with a charge like this, where there's so much at stake for a defendant as well as the complaining witnesses who have to come forward, I think that what's happened is that you have an individual that whose favor is going to be more not on an even keel, but more towards the people coming forward to discuss and tell about the horror that they essentially went through living with this defendant. I don't know that, you know, this Ms. Honda was at the end of the rope, at the end of the line in terms of potential jurors, but certainly if there were more people behind her, certainly I don't think it would have been all that remiss to allow the judge to excuse her and let another juror come forward to see if they would have been better qualified.
What's the judge trying to find, would the judge have to try to find somebody who wasn't offended by that type of crime?
Well, you know, and absolutely, it is a tough call, and there were 12 people essentially that came up that were probably not as offended as Ms. Honda. But nevertheless, the problem is that when you have somebody that comes out, and essentially when you look at the statement she's saying, there are key words, I think, buzzwords here that somebody is sort of telegraphing that indicate that this is really not a case that I am going to be comfortable with. I have an opinion already. You know, I'm looking at this guy over here, the defendant. I probably have already made my mind up in terms of how I'm going to rule. And rather than leaving it up to the state to prove
their
case.
Wasn't her comments not on this particular defendant? I mean, she didn't know anything about him, but on the nature of the charge.
Right, but it was this defendant and the nature of the charge that would have focused on this defendant because he's the accused. So whether it would have been Mr. Vaughn or somebody else, it wouldn't have mattered. It still would have been the fact that the nature of the charges and her opinion that anybody could not do this to children and abuse that position of trust is somebody reviled.
Mr. Groner, there was a long colloquy with Ms. Honda, the
yes.
potential juror. You weren't trial counsel, right? You were
yes.
not trial counsel.
No, I was not.
And so, you know, we're all reading basically transcripts of a discussion that occurred with regards to this juror. And my question to you is that, you know, there are existing standards given the case law in Hawaii as to what we as appellate judges should review.
Yes.
And obviously the trial court judge has wide discretion in sitting a fair and impartial jury.
Yes.
So are you asking us to in any way change the existing standard? Because under the existing standard and given that wide discretion, I'm looking at the Graham case and it says that the reviewing court is bound by the proposition that findings of impartiality should be set aside only where prejudice is manifest. How do you argue that we are beyond that in this case, or are you asking us to change the standard?
Well, this reason why we come here, actually, and it's a two-prong, is for you to review it, and if change is necessary to be made, that you make the change. It's, you know, I personally have done a number of jury trials, and I know that when you have a juror up there and they're expressing essentially what Ms. Honda was expressing is an extreme distaste for this type of offense, regardless, just the mere allegation is enough, that she's saying, you know, I can't be 100%. I have already formed essentially an opinion. She's already saying that I can't be fair and impartial because the nature of the offense is such that I cannot sit with a clear mind and put my biases and prejudices aside.
She did not actually say those words, though. She did not say I cannot be
fair
and impartial.
No, but she said, but when she says that I can't be 100% sure, I mean, it is, and given her prior statements, I think that it's a pretty clear indication that Mr. Vaughn's defense has is even more of an uphill road to hoe to put the state to its burden.
What should the standard be then if you're asking us to change the standard?
Well, I think the standard should be that, you know, rather than manifest, because I think that is an extremely high standard because to overcome. Unless somebody just comes right out and says, I can't be fair, I think the guy is whatever adjectives you would like to use, I can't be fair. And I don't think anybody really wants to view themselves as being that totally prejudiced and biased. And certainly when the court, you know, goes through and I essentially think is rehabilitation to the juror when they're essentially saying, I don't really want to do this. I don't want to be, because I don't necessarily believe I can be fair. But the problem is that when the court comes back and then goes through the colloquy, I view it as essentially attempting to rehabilitate the juror to make it so that, you know, okay, well, yes, maybe I can do this. Okay, maybe, yes. Okay, I will try. But then they're still having to deal with their underlying preconceived notions. And I don't think that anybody can really overcome that.
So are you suggesting the judge was intentionally trying to put a juror on the panel that that judge knew could not be fair or impartial, or that judge was trying to find out whether that juror could be fair and impartial?
I would like to say the latter, Your Honor. I don't ever want to try to, and I don't believe that Judge Hara would essentially do something like that. I don't believe he would do that. So I would say it would be, my position would be more of the latter. But even in attempting to do that, I think that in the case of Ms. Honda, you know, it was a close call. And in the case of a close call, it's out of an abundance more of caution to make sure that there's not a question of the impaneling of the jury. Essentially removing her from the case when she's making these kinds of comments, I don't see that is an error. I think that it is more to making sure that we have a fair process, that a defendant cannot come back and raise these kinds of issues and bring them before you to say, they let this person stay on, I challenged for cause, and as a result of that, I had to use a peremptory challenge, which, you know, we only have three of. This person should have been excused. I should have been able to allow to use a peremptory challenge on another individual who, for whatever reason, I believe, should not have sat.
It was, see, the way that you've put it, it's, you are not reviewing whether it would have been error to strike these jurors. I mean, you know, the question is, having let them stay on, is that error? I mean, it's a very different question.
That's right.
And we're not, even if we were to hold that it was not error to leave them on the jury, it does not necessarily mean that it would have been error to strike them. So I think it's really getting to what is the level of discretion that a trial court properly should have. And, you know, you've addressed in terms of the standard. Basically, I guess what you're suggesting, though, is that if you think that there's the likelihood of, or you can't show that they're going to be fair and impartial, then maybe you should look at striking them.
Exactly. I think
that's the standard that you're suggesting, right?
Correct. I think that if there is that suggestion, I don't want to open up a can of worms so that, you know, everybody, because even though I view the jury system as the hallmark of our society, and that's why it is really very important to make sure that somebody wants that they, you know, people do their civic duty. And as we all know, you know, one of the first questions a lot of times when we do, you know, the questions that come up is, you know, what was your response when you got your jury card? You know, that's one of the favored voir dire questions that's asked of the jurors, you know, and then the voir dire continues from there. So a lot of times, I wouldn't want to suggest somebody to say, well, gee, you know, I really don't like this kind of charge. Well, nobody likes any kind of charge, and nobody likes the fact that we have crimes and these types of things happening. But certainly, I think when you have somebody that comes forward and expresses, you know, an even higher level of issues, emotionally, subjective as well as objective, I think at that point the court can look at behind her to see that there is a larger panel, and that perhaps a different kind of case might have been better suited for this particular juror, perhaps a civil case, perhaps a different type of criminal case.
Seems to me, for all practical purposes, you're sort of asking this court to do a de novo review, that if we were sitting, this is what we would have done.
Well, I don't, perhaps to a certain degree, but I think on the other hand, I think it's just a matter of looking at the fact of when you have not only Ms. Honda coming up, but I think that there are, you know, Ms. Schweitzer, or Mr. Schweitzer, I'm not sure of the gender, but when you have Schweitzer coming forward with, who essentially works in the criminal justice system, is a probation officer, essentially, has strong ties to the probation office. When you have Ms. Everett that comes forward, who talks about her own personal experience in having had somebody break into her home and hold her hostage, and essentially have that horrible experience, I don't think you can put that behind. And when you then go into the facts of this case, which are really bad, you know, these kids, coming forward and describing their life with Mr. Vaughn is, you know, despite the fact that there are issues pertaining to, you know, whether they reported here or they reported over here or they didn't tell you this or that, the fact of the matter is that what these children describe is pretty shocking and pretty horrifying.
But didn't the second juror, the one that had a history of sexual assault,
yes,
say there was she could be fair and impartial?
Well, I mean, they said they could all be tried, but, you know, you have to look at the subjective nature of this, because how can someone who has undergone such a horrible experience actually be able to put that aside and say, okay, I'm going to listen to these children come forward
and talk
about it.
Your position then, because obviously the circumstances of the alleged sexual assault in this case and the sexual assault that took place with the juror were quite different. Would you then argue that any juror that had a direct experience with sexual assault, either being a victim or a family member, could never sit as a juror in a case where the charge was sexual assault? Is that your position?
Well, my position would be that I think the court should be more circumspect in whether or not the juror could actually sit.
Wasn't the court circumspect in having exchange with the second juror?
It did, but I still think that there was a question left even beyond that exchange. And again, given the fact that, given her experience and the facts that were coming down on this particular case, again, when you have a large panel to go through, that again, I don't know what the harm is in allowing this person to be excused.
So, in answer to my question, if someone has been the victim of a sexual assault, has a family member who's been a victim of a sexual assault, could they sit as a juror in a case where it charges sexual assault?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I would say across the board, perhaps there would be individuals that would actually be able to put that aside and be fair.
Isn't that what the juror said in this case? She could put aside and be fair and impartial.
Well, you know, yes, but again, my concern is more of the fact that that experience was so personal to her that I think that in a case like this where you have this type of situation coming down, that just out of an abundance of caution to make sure that
you're essentially saying they can't sit.
Essentially, I would say that you should be more. I'm not going to say they can't sit. I think that's a kind of across
the
board.
What should the judge done in this case that the judge didn't do, that second juror, the victim of the sexual assault?
I'm sorry.
What should the judge have asked that he didn't ask?
I think the judge should have asked, gotten into more of the type of the facts of the case, and to see whether or not this juror could listen to that evidence and put aside her personal experience. I don't know if that colloquy got to that level where, you know, that was actually said. We look more towards Ms. Hahn, who says, I can't believe that any adult would do this. But then on the other hand, when she's given more of a direct position in terms of facts of what's going to be testified to, she's even more appalled. And to say that, you know, this makes it even more difficult for me. And so, because, you know, when you're in a two-week
isn't there
or week-long
some
trial,
discretion in a voir dire, the way a judge conducts voir dire, isn't there some discretion in terms of the how long it's going to go, the questions?
Yes. But again, I think that when you're looking out of this type of case and somebody coming in with such a direct experience, I think that there's more caution that should be alerted to by the parties and especially the court, that whether or not this person could actually be fair and impartial.
But it goes back to, I think, Judge Ginosa's point. Just because, another judge would have done it differently doesn't necessarily mean the way this judge did it was wrong.
Right. Well, as I said, I'm only looking at what the record says. And to say, I'm not saying at all that Judge Hara intentionally let this person on, in order to ensure a conviction. I don't think that any judge would ever do that. I think that what I'm looking at more is to make sure that the process comes forward and appears to be a fair and impartial process, so that when you have individuals like this, that they can be stricken from the process, so that there is not a second guessing in terms of whether or not this individual should have been stricken. And again, the same thing, even more so, I think, with Schweizer, when you have such a close familial and social relationship in someone that's actually working in the system.
Thank you, Mr. Grohner. Ms. Kagawa?
Some of the issues that he discussed, you know, regarding the probation officer, the jurors, Sana Schweitzer in this case. What the record says is that, yes, she was a probation officer for 13 years and did work with the other prosecutor in this matter, prosecutor's wife, Mrs. Kagami, in District Court Probation. However, if you look at talking about the socialization, she said within the past 2 or 3 years, she went to maybe 2 to 5 social activities. It wasn't, I think, I'm not sure, Mr. Groner, for me it was portrayed as that there were social gatherings between the probation office and the prosecutor's office. That's not what it was. From the record, it says that Mrs. Kagami and Ms. Schweitzer had mutual friends, and they may have been at parties together, and that Mr. Kagami was present with his wife. To me, this is unlike the situation where in Kauhi that the court found that it was an error in failing to remove the juror who was a prosecutor in the prosecutor's office. In that situation, there was an appearance of impropriety, but in this situation, Ms. Schweitzer made it quite clear that she called it more like a mere acquaintance with Mr. Kagami rather than any type of relationship to me that would lead to any appearance of impropriety.
Does the record indicate that Ms. Schweitzer clearly did not have any working relationship with Mr. Kagami, having worked in the probation office?
She stated that she may have worked with him on occasion as a probation officer. She would send revocations of probation to the office, and it depends on who it got assigned to. Ms. Schweitzer, at the time, in the record, it does disclose that she had done maybe about two or three revocations, because she had just moved up from a judicial clerk position to a probation officer recently.
So she had done 2 or 3 revocations in total,
right,
in the 13 years that she worked at the probation office.
Correct.
And did it say, does the record reveal how many of those may have been worked on with Mr. Kagami?
No, it didn't. The question wasn't asked exactly how many. She said she didn't do very many because she had just started as a true probation officer rather than a clerk.
Is there an indication as to when those revocation matters occurred vis-a-vis this trial?
She had only recently, within the past year, I believe, become a probation officer working on revocation. As far as exactly when within that year, the record didn't indicate.
Is there some point, counsel, at which social interactions become so significant that recusal of the juror is warranted?
I think so. And in this case, it was in the record, and it was also, I remember Mr. Shidi told me, arguing it, there was another juror, her name was Marilyn Arenado. I don't know what transcript she was in. But in that case, Ms. Arenado was also working in the probation office. She wasn't a probation clerk. That she was stipulated off for cause. But in that situation, had the court inquired with her, and that we did argue that her relationship with the probation or with Mr. Kagami was quite different from the relationship with Ms. Schweitzer. I think that, you know, just knowing somebody, saying them hi to them doesn't delve into any appearance of impropriety versus a relationship where they may come over to your house, know your kids. That's more social, it's a more personal or intimate relationship.
What about working with one spouse?
And I think that question was asked of Ms. Schweitzer regarding that, yes, she worked with Ms. Kagami. Judge Hara did ask whether or not Ms. Schweitzer could still be fair even if let's say she found that he was not guilty, did she think that her finding Mr. Vaughn not guilty would in any way affect her relationship with Mrs. Kagami or the prosecutor? And she said that she didn't feel that there would be any problems or any type of conflict between them because of that. I think the court was also asking regarding, or had indicated regarding the juror Everett, the one who had disclosed the prior incident regarding when she was 18. You know, the court had inquired whether or not Mr. Grano felt that it should be, I guess, a blanket or per se rule that anybody who's a victim of a sex assault or family member can sit as a juror. And I'd like to address that. I know that in State versus LaRue, that issue came up. And for me, that when I look at LaRue, when I read that case, it looks like the juror never disclosed during voir dire, or never came out during voir dire, that she had been a victim of a prior sex assault. But it came out after the trial, or during deliberations, because one of the jurors came forward and said that the juror came forward and basically was telling them that she was sexually assaulted. And I can understand in that situation that her disclosing it, in a way, it bolstered the witness's testimony, sort of saying, hey, it happened to me as a kid, therefore the kid in this case is telling the truth. But I think this situation is different in this sense. Ms. Everett, when discussed about the incident, you know, for her, the incident occurred when she was 18 years old. It didn't occur when she was 3 years old. There's not that issue of do children lie or that type of issue. And the judge, as well as Mr. Shigetomi, actually did quite a lengthy colloquy with Ms. Everett discussing the issue. You know, in this situation, a juror questionnaire was sent and was given to all the jurors prior to coming to court. And part of the juror questionnaire, it does give a very short synopsis of what the case is about, basically stating that the ages of the victims and basically the charges. And I think for anybody, I don't think there's anybody within the community who would say that they don't have any strong feelings about sex assault. It's not something anybody in the community would say, I like sex assault happening. I think it's common that people are gonna have reactions. The question then becomes whether or not they can set those personal feelings aside. And I think the colloquy or the voir dire that was done with Ms. Everett, she basically stated that she could. She even gave an example when Mr. Shigetomi asked, how do you know that you can set aside your emotions and, you know, just decide the evidence on the facts? Ms. Everett disclosed that she was a nurse, and one of her examples was she said, and probably candidly, that there's patients that she doesn't like, but she has to set aside those emotions and deal with them and treat them as a professional. And based on that, to me, she understood what her role as a juror was, and that she stated she would try and set aside her emotion and deal with just the facts.
You mentioned that in LaRue, the juror had not disclosed. I'd like to take you a little far afield from where you are, though, and address something that Mr. Grana didn't have a chance to get to, I think, because we kept him busy in the first part of what he wanted to talk to us about. I wanted to ask about the juror Jensen, who had not disclosed that he was familiar with one of the alleged victims. How common is it that a juror will sit when he or she knows whether well or not one of the victims?
In this situation, and the jurors are given the list of the names, and it said Chris Willems. Mr. Jensen disclosed that he did go to school, I think, for more than a month of culinary school. He didn't realize who he was until he walked in. I don't think he even said he knew his last name. And I think in those situations you can't, I mean, Mr. Jensen was a college student, he was young. I don't know if...
Yeah, I don't mean to suggest that there was anything wrong in Mr. Jensen not disclosing, but I'm wondering if, but that just ties into the Jensen incident. I'm interested in, though, your experience, your knowledge, how common is it that the jurors will be allowed to remain seated or be seated when they do express familiarity with the complaining witness?
I think that it does occur on some occasion depending on their level of the relationship. And I think in this situation, the level of the relationship was he just knew him in class. He actually didn't, there was no personal relationship where he knew, I mean, he didn't even know his last name, which is why I don't think seeing the name on the list made it clear. And I do know that in this situation, or in this case, there are actually several jurors who we have to actually have the juror describe, trying to describe the individual, because we weren't sure if they were talking about the same individual because they would pronounce the names differently. And I think that's a common occurrence. You may not know. Most of the jurors, the way we were able to determine that they knew who the witnesses were in this situation. Mr. Willems was an MMA fighter, and he had a fighting name of Red Bull. And once that was disclosed, or once a juror said that, then we at least knew that we would be talking about the same juror, and the court would be able to question or question them in more detail. It was also discussed regarding Juror Honda, and I think the court did mention it, that she did, towards at the end of the conversation, that said she could be fair and impartial, but she couldn't be 100% sure. And Judge Hara did it in a lot of his colloquies, maybe not with Ms. Honda, but he would describe that jury duty is not something that people do on an everyday basis. It's not something common or normal for them to do. And that I think in jury selection, you're trying to find somebody who can be fair and impartial. You're asking them whether they're going to try. I don't think you can have anybody who would say, yes, I'm 100% sure that I can do it. It's not something, it's not a normal activity, versus can you walk? Yes, I can walk. I can say that 100%. You know, being able to just listen to the evidence, set aside your emotions, is not a common or normal thing for people to do.
What you're also suggesting is when the juror made that statement, at least there was no indication she had ever served on another jury before.
Yes.
So this was a new experience.
Yes. And I think it was discussed regarding how he was rehabilitating. And I think the juror questionnaire, I mean, it said, do you have any strong feelings about sex assault? It's such a general question. I mean, I think I discussed earlier, know many people who would say, yes, I like sex assaults, or, you know, people are going to have feelings, people are going to have emotions. And I think judges questioning is not rehabilitating, it's just trying to clarify to make sure that the juror understands what he's trying to find out, whether or not they can set aside their emotions.
Ms. Kagal, if I could, I'd like to take you back to Juror Schweitzer a little bit. Is there anything that you're aware of in the record that speaks to whether the county prosecutor's office, the county of Hawaii prosecutor's office, has any oversight or supervision vis-a-vis the probation office?
The only thing that was on the record was that as probation officers, if someone violates, they would do a revocation or a declaration and send it to our office, and prosecutor's office would generate the motion for revocation. But that's about it that was discussed regarding any type of.
And if there is a probation revocation hearing, the probation officer would be your witness.
That's correct. That wasn't on the record. I mean, that wasn't disclosed in the record.
That's the way it works,
that's the
right?
Way it works. Yes. And if you have any more questions regarding any of the. Well,
thank you very much.
Your
rebuttal, Mr. Grona.
In rebuttal, I'll just address Mr. Jensen. We have Mr. Jensen, who did have a relationship, not a relationship per se, but certainly knew Red Bull. And when he sees Red Bull come up on the stand as being an individual who goes through this litany of being sexually abused by Mr. on, I think the question really becomes, and when we know that he's gone to school with him, there had been occasions that they'd gone out socially. I think there was questions they'd gone drinking together. He was aware of Chris's being a martial art fighter. And I think that it would come more on, you know, describing these acts on me and how is that going to feel? I know this guy, oh my gosh, this guy, the defendant, did that to him. I think that at that point, it becomes a little bit more testy in terms of whether or not he should have remained on. In my personal experience, if it comes to our attention, that there is a juror who knows a witness, usually it's my preference that that juror gets excused. And the reason for that is because a juror can be placed in a very awkward position given the type of verdict that he comes back on. Because that, you know, if somebody comes up and testifies, a juror knows who that witness is, and they render a verdict adversely, then that could potentially create a problem somewhere down the line between those two individuals. It puts the juror in a very awkward, I think an awkward position. Whether we know it to be or not, I think that just, you know, I just think as a general proposition, a juror who knows a witness is placed in an awkward position. And I think that this was the situation with Mr. Jensen, that even though he came back with all the, you know, I can be fair and impartial, I know who this guy is. So he had already had his mind made up on this person, who he was, his background, and questions of credibility and so forth. So I think that that creates a bit of a problem. And then that's why we have alternates. If Mr. Jensen had this situation come up, and given the nature of this case, and given the type of testimony that this complaining witness had put forward, I think that certainly would not have been a problem to excuse Mr. Jensen in bringing the alternate in.
Even if it wouldn't have been a problem, though, was it manifest? Was prejudice manifest by not doing so?
You know, it's hard to say. You know, we don't know. I mean, that's just one of the questions and why we're here. We don't know. You know, that is the question, I think. And to say whether it's manifest or not, well, to Mr. Vaughn's way of thinking, it would be, because this individual was left on the jury. He knew who this person was, who testified about all these horrible things that Mr. Vaughn did. So for Mr. Vaughn's way of thinking, yes, it would be. And like I said, when you're dealing with the issue of a jury, making sure that they are being fair and impartial, I don't think, and you have alternates to come in and step in these varied types of situations, I think that the better road to have taken would have been to say, we understand, Mr. Jensen, we appreciate your answers that you can be fair and impartial, but the familiarity you have is too close to make it such that maybe you should be excused, just out of abundance of caution and fairness to the complaining witness, to the defense, as well as the state.
So you're essentially asking us to undertake a de novo review of this?
In a roundabout way, I would probably say yes. Yes.
That's a different standard of review than...
I understand. But that's essentially the question. In reading the nature of the appeal, the questions that are being brought forward is that, you know, these individuals came up with issues, personal issues, that raise the question of their ability to be either, you know, fair or impartial, or having a prejudice and bias. And then we go to Ms. Schweitzer. One of the things that, you know, since I get to do criminal defense work, and my clients will sometimes tell me how they get along so famously with their probation officer, my usual comment to them is that that's great, but guess what? When you mess up and you get a violation, guess whose table that probation officer is going to be standing on? It's not going to be ours. It's going to be with the state. So I think that given that fact, I think that Schweitzer, I think, is really very clear, given her responses, that she should have just said, you know, for this type of case, your close working relationship with the prosecutor's office, your social interactions with the deputy prosecuting attorneys, it's too close, and, you know, a different type of case, a civil case, for example, would have been better suited for this particular juror. And when you're looking back and you've got a whole veneer behind you with a number of other individuals, you get another individual to come up and you don't have this question raised on whether or not that juror should have been impaneled. And whether or not, essentially, I would have had to have used, more importantly, whether or not I would have had to have used my peremptory challenge on this individual who clearly should not have been sitting, given the question of impartiality and bias. So that you lose the peremptory challenge for another individual who you sense might have those characteristics, but because they don't come forward to say, that, you know, right outright, that you have to use your peremptory challenge for that individual. And so it's the loss of the peremptory challenge, I think, in a situation like this that is more of a manifest question of, you know, the jury selection process and making sure that you get a jury that is as fair, as impartial as you possibly can. A case like this, I think it's very clear that to get a fair and impartial jury is very, very difficult at best. And so when you have this situation with these types of individuals coming forward to make these types of statements, I think that just out of an abundance of caution and fairness to make sure that you're in fact getting a fair juror doesn't put the judge in a position where he is actually working as a third arm for the prosecutor, that they get a fair and impartial jury. And by having a wide array of individuals to call behind, I don't see that there should have been an issue to just allow that person to stand aside, let someone that come forward without those types of experiences that could be possibly better suited to listen to this type of case. So for that basis, I ask the court that there was error committed, and it is reversible error, and that Mr. Bond should be given the opportunity to have a jury selection process take place that is, in fact, fair, and we don't have unfair, unfavorable, biased or prejudiced jurors sitting in the jury. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Groner. Thank you both. It's very helpful. We'll take the matter under advisement.